all. Happy end of November. This time of the year is special to me, and not just because it's my birthday season. I've always felt like late November into January is a time for reflection about who I am and what I believe in, and this year is no different. In fact, I feel like I'm even more encouraged to think about my life and express extreme gratitude for the love of my friends, family, and people who encourage me to think beyond narrow visions of what a world should be. I'm so thrilled to bring you this month's episode featuring two people who do just that. Anna and Mirto are two of the five co-directors for the Feminist Autonomous Center for Research, or FAC Research, based in Athens, Greece. As scholars and activists, Anna and Mirto embody everything that I want to be. I'm not kidding when I say this podcast session was full of really nervous, excited energy on my part. It's because academics really freak out when you get to speak to people whose work you've read and enjoy, and I'm not an exception. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you all, and so with that, tune in after our theme song.
5, 6, 7, 8. Oh my God. What's up? Oh my God. Tell me. Oh my God. What is it?
Seats at the table. Wow.
Thank you, Anna and Mirto, for joining me for today's podcast. I really appreciate you both taking the time, especially considering our time difference. Just for our listeners, can you introduce both of yourselves?
Okay, so I'm Mirto, and I'm a photographer and a sociologist, and currently based in Athens, Greece, and I participate in the Feminist Autonomy Center for Research.
Hi, Christina. Thank you for having us at Seats at the Table, although it's a virtual table today. My name is Anna, and I am also in FAC Research, and I work on political theory.
Can you talk a little bit about the Feminist Autonomous Research Center? What is that exactly, and sort of how did it come to be?
The Feminist Autonomous Center for Research, or FAC Research, as we like to call it, and the pun is intentional, is a community-based research center which has a physical location in Athens, but also tries to have a kind of virtual or long distance relationships with people all over the world, really, we aspire. And it's a center that aims to kind of question the property relationships around knowledge and the way that the validation of knowledge and its reproduction and its construction happens almost exclusively within universities, which around the world are increasingly exclusionary. Of course, universities have a very exclusionary and elitist history. But if there was a brief moment where they were somehow democratized, or where there were strong movements to try to democratize them, they've become increasingly exclusionary, increasingly inaccessible, and driven by a neoliberal logic of production and consumption of knowledge determined by the dictates of profit. So as a feminist center, FAC Research tries to return to the autonomous roots of knowledge production and to bridge social movement knowledges with academic and more theoretical or empirical research that takes place within or at the margins of universities, and both in terms of the methods and the content of what we do, we try to basically be powered by the members of our community. So in that sense, we like to say we're a community-based research center.
I think that what's really important in the case of Greece is the fact that Greece is not a secular country. So the title of the ministry is Ministry of Education and Religion. And in that sense, you know, there is a religious discourse that sometimes dictates what kind of courses are going to be included and the content of the courses. So this will explain quite a big gap in terms of radical feminism, black feminist theories, queer theories in Greek universities. So for us, this was another reason why we felt strongly that we do need like autonomous research centers that could basically speak to these issues.
There's an underrepresentation or even an invisibility of many radical and potentially insurrectionary traditions of thought in Greek universities. So part of what FAC Research tries to do is to amplify these bodies of thought and also to translate them to the context here through things like community courses, publications, conferences, workshops, etc. But also to excavate the really rich social movement knowledges in the context here that have basically been buried under the kinds of nationalistic and, you know, compulsory religious discourses that Mirta was referencing earlier in the education system.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I actually didn't register that Greece isn't a secular country. And so that actually really helped clarify for me why FAC is such an important addition to certain, at least in the US, the public institution that I go to. The professors that I speak with always acknowledge that, you know, the US university is becoming increasingly neoliberal, but it doesn't seem like there's an intense need for there to be organizing by them outside of the university. Like, they'll just do more like socially engaged research, but still within the confines of the university. But for your case, I think that makes it a little more clear to me, at least, why you can't necessarily do that within the confines of the university in Greece.
I mean, I would challenge that a little bit. And just to say that, you know, some of us within FAC have, experience working in universities outside of Greece, in the US and the UK specifically, and in Canada. And we kind of talk about FAC as being a kind of collective exit from neoliberal institutions. There have been lots of people, particularly feminists and feminists of color in particular, who have kind of written these resignation missives as they, you know, try to explain their reasons for resigning from their jobs or quitting their PhDs or whatever the case may be, leaving the university, why it is that they chose to do this and how it is that they found it to be such a hostile place. And in a way, we kind of propose FAC as a collective exit, because, you know, some of us have made, to some degree or another, individual exits from these institutions. But we think it's also important that we build an alternative form of community and an alternative form of knowledge production outside of the university as a form that has kind of totalized our imagination of what's possible, both in terms of research, but also, and perhaps more importantly, in terms of education. So I would say that like a lot of the debates that are happening about the university in different places, in a way they're not so much happening here, partly because I wouldn't describe the Greek university system as neoliberal. Mm-hmm. It is state, it's a public state-funded system, which has at the undergraduate level universal free tuition. So students do not pay to attend university until the master's level, and then PhDs are free again. So in that sense, although there are differences, still, you know, some of the same conditions of precarity and of lack of democratic governance, to use that term, of these institutions, I think are transnational problems. And FAC, although based here, really does imagine itself as working across and indeed against borders to collaborate with people who, you know, come up against those barriers in academic institutions, but not only, also who are you know, forming community-based alternatives all over the world.
Yeah, and there's also like finally, almost everywhere, a big discussion about, you know, decolonizing institutions and what does it mean practically. But I think that for us, at least, the people in FAC who have previously worked in hegemonic institutions, as Anna mentioned, it was really important to unlearn, like, the tools or the ways, you know, we use to practice research within a certain, within the context of the institution, sometimes dictate our findings and dictate, like, it's really difficult to navigate the relationship between, let's say, you know, our academic selves or our activist selves. So I think it's really important in the case of FAC, the dynamic, but also the exchanges while the community courses are happening, or, you know, that kind of space for me is very precious.
Thank you both. That's this process that I'm going through now as a PhD student is sort of unlearning at the same time as I'm absorbing all of these like hegemonic neoliberal ways of learning and knowledge production. And so it is a little bit or a lot a bit difficult for me to sort of parse through. So I wanted to turn a little bit to political happenings in both of our countries. So I was in Greece right before the 2019 elections in your country. Well, I was there as a graduate student accompanying undergraduates who were there to study like tourism and sports, actually. But the professor leading the trip is a dual Greek U.S. citizen, and he would tell the students a lot about like the history of Greek politics. And so I remember just being like hyper aware of political demonstrations and like a lot of booths that I would see political parties like just handing out information. And that's just something that I don't think I've ever seen in the US. I've seen maybe people like at grocery stores handing out like information in the US, but nothing like really in mass, just like on a day-to-day basis. That's not like an actual protest. So I just remember thinking like, oh wow, Greek people are just really politically engaged, more so than the average US citizen or the average US like person living in the country. I guess I just always envision other democratic nations as being better than the US. And so I know that that's not necessarily true, or like there are always sorts of varying levels of grayness within sort of like positive and negative like binaries. And so I just want to know more about like what are some of the problems that Greek activists are facing because of the Greek political system.
I think in order to answer the question, I have to like, you know, first make a confession, because every time, you know, I tend to ask a question that connects Greece to media democracy, I feel really nervous because of the different layers of history. So for example, you know, all the romanticizing about this being like the birthplace of democracy and civilization in the hegemonic Western mind makes me like a bit uncomfortable, because like, you know, being an activist here and basically not acknowledging or not wanting my belonging to be dictated by the nation state is a tough call, because I mean every form of nation building somehow, you know, is built upon this idea of the glorious past. But in the case of Greece, that glorious past has like the approval of the whole Western world. So it's a national identity and the myth that is really difficult to challenge.
I mean, I think that's interesting, because for me too, the issue I have with the myth of the US is that the US is this paragon of opportunity for immigrants, which is why like all immigrants come here, because the US is so great, and like why would they come to the US if it wasn't great? So people should just stop complaining. So I think that there are these tensions and these mythologies that have been built into what you're talking about, like nation building. It's not just about the making of citizens or citizenship, but it's also about the making of the myths behind what the countries are and what they represent. So yeah, I guess I'm curious then, like, how do you navigate vast propaganda, for lack of a better term, about a country that you're living in and trying to hold accountable in certain ways?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I mean, rather than compare the two situations of for instance, Greece and US, or any, you know, two particular nation states, it could be interesting also to kind of look at the connections between them and the transnational relationships and dynamics that get built over time. So, and, you know, in saying this, I think we can address the second part of the question about how can you challenge or hold accountable state power, given the myths that, in a sense, rationalize or legitimate it in any particular context. Yesterday in Greece, we celebrated, or we commemorated, I should say, the 17th of November, which is the day that a massacre took place during the seven-year colonel's dictatorship, or junta, as it's called, from 1967 to 1974, which was a US-supported military dictatorship that governed the country in a very brutal way. And the massacre took place at the Polytechnic University of Athens, not far from where we're currently staying, and not far from where the Feminist Autonomous Center for Research is located, where students and their supporters had occupied the Polytechnic University, protesting the dictatorship. And the police and the military decided to storm the gates of the university, and did so essentially breaking them open with a tank, and in the process murdered and severely injured several people. And that was sort of the beginning of the end of the dictatorship, because it spurred so many people who perhaps had not found the wherewithal to openly resist prior to that, due to the brutality of the repression, to come out into the streets. And, you know, there were mass protests following these, you know, these horrific acts. And yesterday being the commemoration of this, of course, we are in a pandemic. We are in a lockdown currently. We are facing a situation where the healthcare system has been, you know, systematically defunded through austerity over the last, you know, decade and earlier. And so, you know, people's concerns about their safety and their, you know, loved ones, community safety are, of course, at a paramount. And yet many people felt it was very important to commemorate this massacre, this occasion, this anniversary, in part because of the ways in which the government now is, in a sense, resuscitating or reinvigorating some of the same strategies that this, you know, fascist dictatorship used. And in fact, the government attempted to ban the demos from happening, the demonstrations from happening, deciding that any commemoration and demonstration of 17th of November is illegal. It had earlier this spring into summer legislated certain changes to effectively render any demonstration without a permit illegal, which I know is something that, you know, already exists in so many other countries, including the US, the need to get permits in order to have a demonstration. But here, you know, was a really shocking change. And basically, you know, since this government's election in 2019, and increasingly so over the last year, indeed, one of the other things, let me just, a small parenthesis that it did, was to make universities, which since this massacre have been asylum spaces, well, not since the massacre, since the restitution of democracy with the fall of the dictatorship, one of the first things that that happened was that universities got declared asylum spaces, so that the police was not allowed to enter them, due precisely to the arbitrariness and the violence of the police and the military during the dictatorship. Well, this government, you know, canceled that asylum status of universities. And so, you know, just a few days ago, very violently arrested a bunch of students who, university students and others who had gone into the very same university, the Polytechnic, in order to kind of discuss, you know, using social distancing or physical distancing and masks and all that, trying to discuss, you know, what would the response be? And it's interesting because, you know, I read someone writing that this year, rather than commemorate, the government tried to reproduce the events that led to the massacre at the Polytechnic University. So I think this is kind of a snapshot into the situation that we're facing right now. Another really important aspect of this snapshot, and it really goes to what I'm trying to say, which is that, you know, on the one hand, we are in these states where we are comparing, right? Like to try to make sense of our present, whether in the US or in Greece or in another place, we're trying to make sense of our situation by comparing to the past, right? And so one really live comparison right now is between, you know, this government and the junta government. But I suppose the thing that I would like to suggest and hear your thoughts on is that, you know, we don't have to say that in order for something to count as fascism, it has to look exactly like, you know, previous historical forms of fascism. And I think the clearest illustration of that, in addition to, you know, the repression in cities that I just mentioned, is this government's migration, asylum, and border policy. You know, I think it's not an exaggeration. I use this phrase quite intentionally. The slow motion genocide that it is enacting in the Aegean Sea and on the Aegean Islands, and the ways in which its, you know, entire nation building project within the context of the EU is basically to act like the watchdog at the border of Fortress Europe.
Okay, where to start? So in terms of like activism, at least in the case of Athens, I think that what you mentioned is a fact, like in terms of public space and of how people like exchange and, you know, motivate, or the number of posters or the number, let's say, of slogans or, you know, political, you know, graffiti and street art pieces that you can see while you're navigating the city, creates a particular affective landscape in that sense. But I mean, in the last years, Greece was the epicenter of many crises. Like, for example, the way that the 2008 European financial crisis was played out in terms of Europe, Greece was the epicenter of that and was portrayed in a certain way, like, you know, the pariahs of Europe, the tax evading decadence. So all this brought some kind of public reaction. And we're talking about an already politicized public space. So that was like, you know, a generation of mainly university students that got very politicized. And then what Anna mentioned, so for example, the post 2015 European refugee crisis, again, happened in the context that you had like different strands of the population already participating and being politicized in smaller assemblies. So I think in that sense, there is a very rich culture. I don't know if I want to say of resistance. I don't want to exoticize it, but there are reactions and anti-authoritarian and leftist intellectualism. And currently a very strong feminist movement as well.
Thank you both for those like very comprehensive answers. That gives me a lot to reflect on. And I mean, I think that for me, it's really hard not to sort of try and do a compare-contrast thing because, as Anna said, we're all trying to sort of make sense of what's happening in our respective countries, but also, like, the linkages between them. Can you talk a little bit about fascism or this sort of turn to fascism? And Anna, I do like how you mentioned that even though there are similarities between what's happened in the past, the mechanisms of fascism have changed. Just like I think that for social movement activists, like the mechanisms of social movements have changed. There wasn't social media like 20 years ago, and so a lot of social movement activism has revolved around digital activism in ways that are so different than they would have played out before. But at the same time, like the enemy or like the government or whatever institutions of power that you're acting against have also changed mechanisms. So can you talk a little bit more about those new mechanisms that you see, whether it's migration policies and the refugee quote-unquote crisis, instead of like how those things have evolved?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very challenging question.
I mean, one thing that jumps to mind is, for example, you know, linking it back to the whole Black Lives Matter discourse. In Greece, we never really had a discussion about whiteness and what that means in the context of the Mediterranean, because it's like a completely different context to talk about whiteness. So after 2015 and what Europe has called the refugee crisis, a racialized discourse was very, you know,
prominent
in Greek politics and in Greek media. It was very timely and important for any kind of movement, whether it was the leftist, the feminist, the queer, the anti-authoritarian movement, to start talk a little bit about, you know, again, this myth of Greece being this white country, this white birthplace of democracy and civilization. I mean, and how even the marbles of the Acropolis were whitened from different colonizers in order to build on that discourse of whiteness. Basically, that would be like an example that connects, you know, to different movements and struggles and how social conditions, it's one crisis after another and it's going to be like that, we know that now, shift activist thoughts and strategies.
Yeah, I mean, the construct of crisis is a mechanism in a way to try to answer your question or to attempt something like a partial answer. You know, I think we need to be really wary of what all these declared crises are about and what the mere fact of their declaration tries to accomplish. I feel that with crisis, with a declaration of any crisis, there's a kind of inversion between the cause and the effect, the lived experiences of people who are targeted for forms of violence, exploitation, oppression, and the discursive construction of what the problem is, basically. So to take the example of the declared refugee crisis, the so-called refugee crisis, the crisis from the point of view of Europe, of European institutions, is the arrival of people in Europe seeking asylum, which basically means that the crisis consists in people fleeing war and fleeing economic devastation, fleeing extractive capitalism, fleeing environmental and ecological catastrophe, fleeing whatever they may be fleeing, political persecution, that the crisis becomes a crisis for Europe when those people actually survive and arrive on, you know, what are named the shores of Europe, which is a complete inversion from both the point of view of these people and from the point of view of anyone who cares about social justice and other human beings and non-human beings. Rather than celebrate their survival and arrival and welcome them and live up to their, in fact, legal obligations under the Geneva Convention and under international law, European institutions and European member states have waged nothing short of an undeclared war on people seeking asylum or attempting to seek asylum or even simply attempting to survive and cross into the territory that is called Europe. So I think crisis is one mechanism. It serves to separate out populations for differential state treatment. Some people are meant to survive and reproduce and even thrive, even profit. Other people are basically consigned to death at various velocities. That is something to which movements here had to kind of adjust. There has been a separation for many years between anti-racist, anti-fascist, anti-authoritarian, and feminist movements and queer movements. And somehow in this situation, the divisions between anti-fascist and anti-authoritarian movements and anti-racist movements, particularly those that are led by migrant communities, racialized communities within Greece. People who have been, you know, living here for many years while, you know, the state and the Greek society, the dominant Greek society, denied the existence of anyone non-Greek, basically. And, you know, it's very often that we hear that, you know, prior to 1990, for example, with the fall of the Soviet Union and the first war on Iraq, prior to this date, there were no migrants in Greece. Well, this is, you know, completely false, obviously. But a certain narrative about who is present somewhere also affects the imaginations of the movements that, you know, seek better conditions of life or even to transform completely the social structure or the social relations comprising the society. And, you know, it's really quite recently that the connections between anti-fascist struggle, anti-racist struggle, feminist struggle, anti-authoritarian and anti-capitalist struggle, and anti-heteropatriarchal struggle have come into relief. And I think that part of the reason is that these crises have somehow intersected. And through their intersection, we see that not only that, you know, they target different groups differentially, both discursively and materially, but also that again and again, certain groups completely fall through the cracks of being affected by the phenomena that these crises supposedly name. Like, for example, austerity politics, which is supposedly the solution to debt, but is in fact, you know, the cause of debt. So by looking at, you know, who falls through the cracks of these declared crises, I think movements started to feel the need, I'm not saying that this has been accomplished, but feel the need or feel the pressure to kind of form coalitions and form, you know, a kind of common understanding of the relationship of these things that seem to be unrelated to one another. Like, what's the relationship between, for example, a Canadian-based mining company wanting to extract gold from this region in Chalkidiki in northern Greece? What's the relationship between that and, for example, endemic rates of gendered violence in interpersonal, but also in, you know, in public, street level and institutional forms that it takes? And these things that seem unrelated actually converge in the policies of a state that, in relation to supranational institutions and to other states, seems intent on making people's lives unlivable, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, and if there's one point that I think connects different struggles, is this idea of crisis, or the concept of crisis, always presupposes the idea of normality or normativity, whether like normativity existed before the crisis, and then crisis is always already seen as something ephemeral. So don't worry, we're going to go back to normality. And I think what I've seen beautifully written in the streets of Chile, in the streets of Athens, in the streets of New York, is that, you know, we're not going back to normativity because that was the problem. So I think that kind of questioning of the structures and of the institutions, but also on the daily practices of what used to constitute normality, is really crucial and important.
All of those points help to, I don't know if necessarily give me hope, but because it's sort of hard to have that sort of like sense of optimism during this time, but I think it sort of helps ground the reasons why, at least for me, I feel so anxious about what's to come, at least for like us with our new presidential election. Like, we have a new president-elect, although our current president is sort of like still saying that we don't have a new president-elect, but maybe by the time this podcast is released, that'll change, who knows. But I think I've been feeling some apprehension about like celebrating that we have a new president-elect because of this idea that, oh, well, now that we have a new leader, or like we're having a new sort of administration overall, things will go back to normal, or things will go back to being at least like manageable. For me, and for a lot of, Myrtle, as you mentioned, like activists that I know or activists that I've seen, luckily a lot of people are not okay with just going back to normal. They want to create a new sort of normalcy that doesn't have all of these crises constituted within that sense of normal, I suppose. And I guess to that point about crisis, I've been thinking about Black Lives Matter a lot. And at least in our like media discourse, we don't constitute it as like a crisis necessarily. But I think in the ways that we frame, or like the general public frames Black Lives Matter, like it's seen as this crisis, like those major cases that have been, you know, in the public eye, like Breonna Taylor or George Floyd, like once those families get justice, then the crisis is over. But as we know, like Black Lives Matter isn't just about one or two incidences, but it's about sort of this legacy of anti-Blackness and the ways that the police impart differential racialized policing, essentially. So yeah, I think this idea of crisis, both when you use the term crisis, but also when you sort of impart the idea that something is a crisis, it can sort of shift public consciousness about like what resolution would look like or should look like. I know we're like running so low on time, but I really did want to touch upon like Golden Dawn and the rise of fascism in Greece and to some extent across the broader Europe, because I think that for my listeners, it might be helpful to sort of understand what maybe one model of a country condemning fascism looks like. Not to say that, again, that Greece is like this paragon of ethics or anything like that, but I guess how it sort of come to be, because they were on the rise, right? And so I think it would be interesting, at least for me, to learn about like how that process was, but then also what ramifications that has, if any, on the ways that activists are mobilizing and what their priorities are.
So Golden Dawn started out as almost like a secret society, a very fringe underground organization in 1986 that was an explicitly ethno-nationalist and national socialist, that is a Nazi organization. Then during the 90s and 2000s, started participating as a political party in elections. And in 2012, after some smaller electoral victories, mostly in local government, it entered parliament with votes constituting it the third largest party in parliament. So after this election, it gained a great deal of visibility and popularity in that it was presenting itself as, you know, this nationalist party at a time of crisis that was anti-systemic, that was, you know, basically providing a third way in relation to the, you know, the dominant electoral political parties that had dominated politics until that time. And it channeled people's frustration with the economic devastation they were facing, as the lenders, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the World Bank were inflicting. So they were kind of an anti-austerity party at that point. They were an anti-Europe party. They wanted Greece to leave the European Union, particularly the European Monetary Union. And they really positioned themselves in ways not unlike other, you know, populists like Trump or Bolsonaro, or present themselves as somehow outside of the mainstream. At the same time, as Golden Dawn was rising into power on the sort of electoral front, its paramilitary wing was attacking people in public space, attacking violently, injuring fatally, and killing people whom they constructed as not belonging to the nation. That is, racialized people, people with a migration background, queer and trans people, leftists, anarchists,
feminists,
anyone really that, you know, ran counter to their vision of, you know, the normative heterosexual ethnic Greek subject. And things really came to a head after the murder of a rapper, Pavlos Fissas, in 2013, where basically the person who stabbed him to death was arrested immediately and confessed immediately to the murder. He was a Golden Dawn member. Initially, Golden Dawn tried to disown him, disclaim him. But after a long inquest, which lasted 9 months, the Court of Appeal charged 69 individuals, including the leadership of Golden Dawn, the members of Parliament and the members of European Parliament from the 2012 elections. They were charged with multiple crimes, the most overarching of which was membership in a criminal organization or leadership of a criminal organization. And, you know, the trial, which began in April of 2015, you know, counted crimes, counted acts, criminal acts committed since 2008, and was a very complex and almost unwieldy case, which on October 7th of this year was decided. And the court basically issued its ruling in the case. So it's a trial that lasted, you know, 5 years and 454 days. You can get a sense of its extent and the extent of, you know, the violence that the accused had wrought on the society. You know, they were found guilty on all counts, and it was sort of hailed as sort of the biggest trial of neo-Nazis since the Nuremberg trials. And in that sense, you know, sets an important precedent for at least, I think, not only the Greek legal system and democratic system, but globally, it sets an important precedent. Now, you know, all of this is really important. And I think it's really important to notice that it couldn't have taken place without a really strong and dedicated and persistent anti-fascist movement. But I think what's really important to also pay attention to is what happened immediately after the verdict was announced. Outside the courthouse, there were hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, a million protesters peacefully demonstrating, calling for some semblance of justice in the case, calling for a guilty verdict, or at least there anyway to witness what many hoped would be a guilty verdict. And what happened immediately after the verdict was announced, and it was sort of communicated to the crowd through a loudspeaker, was that the police, completely unprovoked, attacked a peaceful demonstration with water cannons, with tear gas fired out of rifles, with noise grenades. And, you know, this couldn't have been a clearer statement of, you know, the relationship between the state and the parastate in the context of Greece. All throughout this time, we were learning that a great majority of the police were voting for Golden Dawn, support Golden Dawn. Even in the incident leading to Fisas's murder, they were very slow in reacting and did not attempt to prevent Fisas from being killed, and then reacting in a very slow way to apprehend the murderer. All throughout this, the police has really shown itself to be, well, to put it bluntly, like on the side of the neo-Nazis. And so on the one hand, this guilty verdict is, you know, a kind of quote unquote win in the terms set out by the criminal legal system. On the other hand, as also evinced by, you know, the recent events of yesterday that I was narrating earlier, the concern with, you know, fascism and neo-Nazi ideology and totalitarianism is not limited to this political party. It's not limited to an extremist fringe. And I think it's a mistake to simply locate it there. So, you know, for me, the attacks of the state through the instrument of the police on people protesting in a completely peaceful way at, you know, at this, you know, hugest trial perhaps in contemporary history since the fall of the dictatorship in Greece, and arguably even since the fall of the Nazi power in Germany, is in a sense subverted, or we might say we are reminded what the relationship between these extremisms are might be in relation to a political sphere that occupies the what we might call the extreme center and goes completely, you know, taken for granted, especially when we have these fringe, you know, extreme right parties to kind of compare it to, which kind of goes back to what you were saying, Christina, I think, in terms of feeling this discomfort with celebrating the win of a lesser evil, let me put it that way, in the US presidential elections. You know, we're all over the place, basically being pushed into thinking of some kind of complacency or even wishing for these lesser evils. And I guess I wonder, how can we see the rise and the fall of Golden Dawn in Greek politics as symptomatic also of the entrenchment of nationalism as a completely acceptable discourse within Greek, but, you know, other nation state politics, you know, writ large? Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer.
No, it was a passionate one. And I completely agree with everything that Anna said, but, you know, just a one reminder, because usually when, you know, we take these spectacular emblematic moments mm-hmm. as like, you know, the end of fascism or the trial or the outcome of the trial, which, as Anna explained, lasted for 5 years. But I think I'm going to be provocative here, and I'm going to say that, you know, at least activists all over the world, not only in Greece, are aware of the links between fascism and neo-Nazism and state politics. And we know that, you know, fascism is not a radical ideology in the sense that it doesn't go against certain hegemonies of the world. But other than that, I don't believe that, you know, you cross an ideology in the court, or let's say through state justice. So what I'm trying to say is that there was already within these 5 years, and even before that, a huge, amazing Antifa movement with daily subversions and tactics. And I mean, at times, you know, even a violent, in that sense, anti-fascist movement that was crossing, like, you know, with the fascists in certain neighborhoods. So first, there was this, not exactly social agreement, not like the 100% of Greek population, but there was this idea that basically we don't want Nazis here. And I'm talking about a country that has a history of Nazi occupation. So it's really difficult to go back into the social memory and retract the stories. So in the Antifa movement, it wasn't just the usual suspects, you know, like, I don't know, like the anarchists or the students or the younger population. It was also our grandparents, in that sense, that had an embodied experience of what it means to be occupied by Nazis. And that is what made it huge in Greece. So I think that that is also important, because I don't know what the outcome of the trial could have been if there was no such, you know, direct and massive, massive social response against Golden Dawn.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say, for people who would like to learn more about it, there is an open access ebook on the website of Rosa Luxemburg Institute in Greece, written by Dimitris Psaras, who is a journalist whose investigations into Golden Dawn, his decades-long research into Golden Dawn, actually formed part of and proved indispensable to the case. It's called Golden Dawn on Trial, and you can find it at rosalux.gr. And there's another organization which reported from the trial, like painstakingly documented what was happening in the trial, in each of its meetings, called Golden Dawn Watch. So you can read there in English. Both of these are available in English as well as in Greek. You can read there in English, you know, sort of what the trial was about, all of the complex cases that it involved, and of course its outcome. So that website is goldendawnwatch.org.
So just, I guess, just to sort of wrap up, what's next for both of you in your individual work and or for FAC research? And what are your dreams for the future? To end sort of on a hopefully positive note.
What a beautiful question.
It is a beautiful question. Well, for me, there's an easy answer, living in the era of pandemic. I miss human touch. I miss this embodied experience of being together. So, and I think FAC Research and other feminist spaces and feminist collectives are built on that. Mm-hmm. So my dream for the future is to be able, and not to forget how it feels when our bodies are together in space. So yes, as cheesy as it is, I long and I dream of that kind of togetherness, whether it's in occupations of public space or just occupations of smaller research centers like FAC.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very nice answer. I think it's very difficult to, you know, keep our eye on the prize, as they say, nowadays, and kind of look out to that horizon of hope. But I guess I am emboldened. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Christina, the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, the insurrections and insurgencies that were happening around the United States, and then that kind of spread to many parts of the world, including here. And I guess I'm emboldened and I'm inspired by people's courage in resisting all over the world. And I don't know, I guess on behalf of FAC Research, I'd like to issue an invitation to all our listeners. If their travel should bring them this way, if and when we're able to travel again, and they find themselves in this corner of the world, to get in touch. They're always welcome. And I guess I at this point, I'm just trying to keep my head above water, to be quite honest with you. And, you know, hope that the situation in the world shifts and that, you know, we find ways to kind of acknowledge what's happened and, of course, grieve it, grieve all the losses that, you know, the world has suffered through this pandemic, but also through, you know, everything else that's been happening at the same time. I don't know. I think it's important to kind of appreciate even just a conversation such as this through this platform and, you know, the ways in which we've managed to kind of come together despite all of this physical distance, even in very difficult conditions, and to find hope in that.
Well, all, thanks for tuning in for this month's session of Seats at the Table. I hope conversations like today's allow you to learn more about what's happening in the world around you. And as a new year swiftly approaches, consider making room in your life to reflect on your dreams as well. If you're interested in any of the sources mentioned in today's session, including information about FAC Research and access to Anna Emerta's latest book, Reproducing Refugees, Photographia of a Crisis, please view the podcast description box on your podcast app or on the Seats at the Table website. You can visit our site at www.seatsatthetable.com. I hope that you all keep safe, wash your hands, wear your mask, and do your best to protect yourself and your loved ones this pandemic season. Please know that our actions will continue to impact people in our communities, in our country, and internationally as well. It's been a rough time, but I know that if we think collectively, we'll get through this together. Sending you all lots of love. Catch you next month. Bye.